This is March 12th, 2008. This is Mike Smith interviewing Bill Schumer in the offices of General Linen and Uniform. During our last session, I think we sort of took you through your early life. We spoke a bit about your father and family and the startup of the business. We talked about your education and some of your early experiences. I think we got you to Detroit and into the family business, reluctantly, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'd like to talk a bit more about your experiences with the business. And I wonder if you could start by just, again, describing in general how you think, your feelings about this business and how it fits into the larger Detroit area.
Well, they indicated it earlier. I was not too happy coming here. For this business, a highly educated guy, probably.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, Normie.
That was not appropriate for me to be in this business. A grungy business. We're picking up soiled stuff from hundreds of businesses and so forth. But I adapted to it, and I came to like it and got more active in it as I learned more about it.
And tell me again the size of the business at this time and
when I came here, General Linen was doing $10,000 a week in sales. Okay. And that was about a medium-sized company at that time.
Do you recall how many employees there were?
Not really. Not the exact number.
Ballpark?
Well, we must have had we had about 7 routes, I would guess. And then we, of course, the backup and the plant. You guys haven't seen our plant. I'd like you to come down and see what we do. Anyway, let's see. What was my point?
I'm sorry, I interrupted with general idea of the size.
Well, we're doing now. We're over $200,000 a week. Yeah, the casino has pushed us over that, and we're hoping to close the other casino. Momentarily, we're biting our fingernails on that contract. So we've grown, we've acquired companies throughout the years. At one point, we were running 3 plants. It was before the strike. We had bought a company in Ann Arbor by the name of Varsity Linen. We have a picture on the wall of which originally was a family laundry and then went into the linen rental business. This was a family that you might be of interest. Dalitz, does that name ring any bell with you? Dalitz. Mo Dalitz was connected with the mafia. And he, 2 brothers were partners in Varsity Linen, and each one had a son. Mo Dalitz was there's a French phrase, I can't bring it up. we'll just attribute it to.
That's all right.
Forgetfulness. He was not, Mo was not in the Ann Arbor business, although his father was a partner in it. Maury ran the business. Maury had been, they had moved to Ann Arbor and were.
This is the father.
Yes, right. And Maury was very active in the business community in Ann Arbor. We would walk down Main Street there and 5 out of 10 people would say, "Hi, Maury, how are you?" He was well-known in the community. And he had a plant on 5th and can't remember the other street, near downtown Ann Arbor. Do you know Ann Arbor at all?
A little bit.
Okay.
A little bit.
And anyway, when we bought the business, he didn't want to sell us the plant. He just sold us the routes. There were three or four routes at that time, Ann Arbor and environs. And we operated it as we set it up as a separate corporation, and we rented his plant. He retained the property. He wanted to sell it, and eventually did, to the U.S. government. It's now a post office. For 5 years, though, we were tenants in that property. And that was interesting, the acquiring of the business, the integrating it into our method of doing business.
Was this the first acquisition by your company?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Over the years, there were smaller ones. I don't recall. I wasn't involved in them, but this one I was involved in.
What year was this? Or general time frame?
Well, let's see.
75.
I don't remember the year.
70s?
Let's see. I'm trying to think. Our strike started in 70.
18.
End of 78. And we were we had Varsity at probably 2-3 years before that, the strike. And problem of manager training, policies, deciding what areas to cover. This was all in my purview. And a separate corporation. In fact, during the strike, my good friend from the union threw a picket line around the place, but he had to rescind the picket line because it was a separate corporation. General Linen Inc. was on strike, not Varsity was on strike. So we had a minor right. victory. We could operate during the strike, which helped us a little bit. In terms of processing and serving customers in between and so forth.
So this was in 1975 that you acquired a company. This was the same year you became president. Was it?
My father was living. I became president. Is there a legal recording that I became president? Because I thought I became president after he passed away. And he was alive during the strike, so I'm not sure what's
clear. Sure.
Yeah.
We had to pause for a moment. So you were telling the story of 1975, merging of the two, or that General Linen purchased Varsity, and you spoke about.
I was active in integrating the two companies were. Coordinated and so forth, although there are separate staff, separate delivery, and so forth. So,
and Maury, who you mentioned, had run Varsity Linen in Ann Arbor. Then you mentioned the son, who was in the Detroit area.
No.
Maury
was the son of the two brothers
that
we acquired Varsity from. Okay, and Maury had been in service and had run a quartermaster laundry for the U.S. Army. That was his cup of tea. But he was very unhappy with the business. They did some personal laundry, and certain people in Ann Arbor would come in and complain about how they pressed the shirts. And he just couldn't take that. And that was why he wanted to get out of the business. They owned Ann Arbor. At that time, most businesses were local. Okay, as time went on, as we from a Detroit company came in and acquired, this happened all over the Ann Arbor retail area and so forth. So, and of course later the public companies came in. These were national companies. But at that time, we used to say we owned Ann Arbor for the linen business, okay? Like we're now saying we own Detroit for this business. You know, the competition has faded away and so forth. Anyway, we, after 5 years of renting their plant, he sold the property to the U.S. government. They subsequently built a post office. And we, at that time, bought a competitor in Ypsilanti. Can't think of the name of the company. Also a locally owned company. And they decided to go out of business. There was a father had started it, and the son was in it. And they weren't doing so well. So we bought their property in Ypsilanti. And were there for any number of years. I don't really remember how many years. And operated a plant there. Well, in that interim, utility rates skyrocketed as they are now. And so we've calculated it was best to shut down the plant and convert it into a branch, which meant it was a delivery point, but not a production point. And so the work came to Detroit, and we had to relay it to the distribution point. That time we had about four or five routes in the Ann Arbor area. We extended our coverage. We went out to what's the city to the north?
Brighton?
No, farther north than Brighton.
Oh, Flint?
Flint. We started to go to Flint from Ann Arbor. Anyway, and we had a manager, and I was not having good relations with Isaac Litwack. I was having conflicts with him all the time. He was a very intellectual guy, and he was on the verge of being a communist. He was not a communist. Would never have subjected himself to discipline, and he wanted to make the decisions, and that was the conflict that we constantly have. One instant illustrates this specifically. At the time, the Taft-Hartley bill was in effect, and we were required to, our contract required us to hire through the union. So I would call up Isaac, and Isaac, I need a man. So he'd send me a man, interview him. A couple days later, he called me and said, did you hire him? I said, no. I said, I'd like to talk to a few men. He said, what's wrong with this man? He wanted to do the hiring, in effect. And that ran against the grain. Anyway, so that was just one of probably tens of conflicts that developed during the thing. And when we acquired Varsity, they were not organized. They were not unionized. So I specifically told a guy who was handling our labor relations, I said, is there a way we can avoid coming into Isaac's union? I didn't need any more tyranny. So he arranged that we signed up with the upstate union that was centered in Lansing, I believe. And so that we had a different contract. It was a different corporation, and because of that, their picket line had to be removed by the NLRB during their great conflict.
Well, let me step back to something you mentioned earlier that that I'm curious about. When you were talking about Varsity, you mentioned there were some mob connections.
With the cousin, not with this. Maury was pure as the driven snow. Let's put it this way: Maury was a straight guy. He would have no truck with these guys. And his cousin moved to Cleveland, and there was a linen supply that he got affiliated with called Pioneer Linen. And then they were just starting Las Vegas at the time, okay? And the Teamster Fund was financing it, okay? The money was coming from the Teamster. You know, we were collecting our aprons and towels and whatnot and paying them, and they were sending the money to Las Vegas, which I think turned out to be a great investment for them and for the country later, but at that time it was not savory. In our view. How did I get off on that?
I got off on it because I asked you.
Oh, okay.
the mob thing I'm just curious about, because, you know, there's there was a reputation, and I'm speaking personally here, that the laundry business was fairly well mobbed up in Detroit. No. And in the shop I worked in, on the first day I started, that's what I was told.
Which and company was it?
This was Mechanics Laundry. Oh. And I wondered, you know, there. I'm not taking a position one way or the other.
Okay,
I'm asking you.
It was not true. One company that started up, and I can't tell you when, Melrose Linen. And interesting story. Two guys, thugs, I guess I would describe them now, as long as I'm safely away, came into my dad's office, and I was in the office. We had adjoining offices.
When was this, 50s?
I don't remember.
Okay.
You'll be able to look it up. Melrose Linen.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Toco and Zarelli, those names should resonate with you somehow.
Toco does.
Yeah, and
Zarelli.
Zarelli was an in-law or something. They were interrelated, and they told my father, who was head of the association at the time, we are going into the laundry business, linen supply business, and we want every company to donate business to us to get started, so we don't have to fight for it. Well, my father was no great hero physically and whatnot. He said, well, I got to take it up with the board and so forth. Well, naturally, the answer was no. And now Isaac resisted this company. Hoffa wanted, well, the company wanted to be organized, and Isaac wouldn't give him the tickets to become part of his union. And he had a struggle with Jimmy Hoffa, and he lost the struggle, as you would imagine. But he had a continuous struggle. He was a captious, that's the good word, okay, a captious man. He didn't take no shit from nobody, okay? You know, I mean, he says, he was a little guy, but, you know, powerfully built and so forth. And at any rate, Melrose got started, and they had connections with the Teamsters, that some of the agents were their buddies. They did favors back and forth. And, of course, a hangover from the Prohibition days when liquor was imported across the Detroit River and the speakeasies abounded in Detroit, they had connections with bars and restaurants. I don't know if one restaurant, if I can recall the name, that was on Woodward, was a big restaurant. Vanelli's. Does that ring a bell? You're not old enough to know about it, but you never heard of Vanelli's restaurant? Mm-hmm. It was almost a block long on Woodward Avenue, just south of Six Mile Road. Mm-hmm. There, all they had to do was call on the phone. We're in business, and the Italian community was intimidated by these guys. They were Sicilians. Most of the Italian community here hated the Sicilians. They were not persona grata in the Italian community, but they feared them, okay, even though they disliked them and so forth. So for a couple of years there were struggles over stops, especially Italian stops, and they there was another company that was sort of mafia tinged called Clean Linen. The owner was Louis Riccardi, who was a hitman at one point, and his partner was Red Colin. This Red Colin was Jewish, and they were not getting along, and we ended up buying that company. They had a plant on Claremont. Do you know where Brady's School is?
Yeah.
Okay. Right next door to the Brady School. Anyway, we ended up... I'm going to tell you something. I don't know if I should tell you some of this stuff. They were, you know, largely... This anteceded Melrose Linen, okay? But Melrose was a strong effort by these people to penetrate the business. When we bought Clean Linen, they liked to deal with honest people. You know, the gangsters, they didn't like to deal with crooks. So they should have sold to Melrose Linen, because, you know, they were both cut from the same cloth, so to speak. But they preferred dealing with my father, that he had a good reputation and so forth. Anyway, we debated in our family, should we or should we not go through with this business, because we knew it was vulnerable to Melrose. You know, they just had to make a phone call. Had nothing to do with price, had nothing to do with service, had to do with connection. And anyway, we bought the company, sold the plant to a supplier of ours, who was a manufacturer. It's now a laundry plant. They do Ford, their biggest account is Ford Hospital. Mm-hmm. I can't think of the name of it just right now. Any rate, but we decided on a scheme, and I was part of figuring out how to do it. We did, because it was so vulnerable, we took in a partner in the deal, and we insured one another that if we lost any of the business, we would share the cost of that. That was our neighbor and friend, Progressive Linen, owned by the Hertz and Nickerman family. They were two partners, two family partners. And we sold off certain amount of the other routes, so that we bought them, but we minimized our risk. Mm-hmm. In taking them over, because you could buy it and then not have anything. That was it could have happened, and we did lose a lot of the especially the Italian business. Just
how long did Melrose last? Is it still in existence?
No. They decided probably about 10 years ago that they couldn't make enough money in the linen business. And the advantage to them, you know, from our viewpoint, I don't know how accurate this is that they had hot money, and they could turn that money into linen stops by, well, we had a big bar downtown, the famous bar before your time, maybe before your time even, and they would send in their people and inundate them with buy everybody drinks and, you know, splurge money at them. They had cash. It wasn't worth anything. I mean, I guess. And that was another way, besides the Italian connection and the fear that they had a lot of money to disseminate. This was linen, not industrial, okay?
Right. We're just speaking about the linen industry. Linen.
At that time, it was separate. Yeah. Anyway, where did I...
So I asked a question about the mob, you know, out of ignorance, just to get your opinion, because there is, of course, this concept of urban myths, you know, that develop, and that's why I asked. So, to the best of your knowledge, Melrose was the only laundry business that may have had the so-called mob connections.
Yeah, and Clean Linen, the
right,
other one
that you
I
mentioned, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The other companies were, in some cases, hard-working, hard-drinking, hard-whoring owners, all of these things, okay? later, to follow up on Melrose, they sold their linen business, and a couple companies, if you talk to Bruce Colton, they bought a share of that, so he would be... anyway, we weren't involved in that deal at all. And, when Clean Linen was for sale, Hoffa called my father, Jimmy Hoffa, and wanted to be a partner with him in buying that business. Of course, that would have protected, you know, the business. Our fear was we're going to lose it all and so mm-hmm. forth. So we handled it another way. And my father toyed with the idea, but between my mother and me, we said, what do you need this guy for? You know, you don't need him. He's not going to do anything. But he could have augmented sales just again with the Teamster connections.
Mm-hmm. This was when Hoffa was president, so it was after 57, 1957. Was this in the 60s then we're speaking about?
I can't place it because
my
mental condition, let's put it that way. I really can't tell you. But you can, in the legal trails, you really can...
There are ways to look
to
up
find
the information,
it,
but I just...
My mind's
recall,
not one of them, that's...
All right, we can place it later. But I was very curious about that, and partly because of my own experience, partly, again, because of, the myth out there.
Well, we had an arrangement, I got to tell you about this. You'll be interested in this, Mr. Consular. You studied about the NRA, and the NRA really was the impetus in the country for organized labor. FDR wanted the unions to get organized, and they did. UAW was nothing before the New Deal. And as part of it, as part of the NRA, they encouraged pricing codes for various industries. Okay. Part of our problem all the years was price cutting all the time. And this was part of the struggle with Marathon Linen, and besides the ethnic struggle, the philosophic struggle. My dad was a Democrat, and Mr. Giannamatis was a staunch Republican, and you know, and the it's right now the in the election the hatred and competition is almost reminiscent of the 30s in my mind. Okay, I don't know if you remember the period. It was it was in a depression. People were unemployed. Red lines, there was unemployment, and I mean, Detroit was terrible. The conditions were horrific. Anyway, how did I get on that?
I think you were speaking.
Oh, yeah. So, as a result of that, the association had a price list that they tried to enforce among its members. Unsuccessfully, I have to say, everybody cheated on the thing. But on the surface, there was a price code, and it was started with the NRA. That really encouraged it. And then later, in fact, well, you asked me some of the things I did in the company. Companies kept records of stops lost to competitors. We had a list. I had a list for every competitor. We had a list of we lost this stop, and it was worth $100 a week. And we lost this stop. And on the other, it was a ledger, gained and lost. And, you know, this is... certainly illegal, and by today's laws, and but it was a method of keeping the industry alive and keeping the price levels where they could survive. Okay, and many did not. However, there was a change in the law that. What the hell was the change? That had to do with interstate commerce, that our lawyers said that we were not subject to the federal antitrust law, okay, until the interpretation of who was in interstate commerce was changed, and that at this point, it had to be sometime in the, I'm guessing, in the late 30s, maybe early 40s, that if you bought your goods across state lines, you were in interstate. At that point, this whole system blew up and it couldn't exist anymore. So the industry went to contracts with individual customers, and we still do. We have, you'll want to see our contract. I'll give it to you. We try to get our customers to sign contracts, and that we try to hold them for a certain period of time. So, competitor comes in, I'll save you money. That's his first pitch on trying to get the business, as we do. You know, we're no different. And we, as part of the contract, we had arbitration clauses in there. If they broke the contract, and many of them did, we would take the customer to arbitration. Well, they didn't want this bullshit. You know, I had to hire a lawyer and so forth. For many years, we would arbitrate lost accounts. And in some cases, we made settlements. You know, I'm amazed that... How well, for example, here was one that you asked me, you know, my involvement in the business. We had a large account, over $1,000 a week. I can't remember the name of the company. It was a food company, and they decided to close, again, because of union threats and problems, they closed the Detroit plant. Well, that left us high and dry. And we had a contract that extended for another couple of years. So I participated in this personally with my general manager, who we'll have lunch with. We're going out for lunch. You guys can take that, okay? Anyway, so we made a settlement with them not to arbitrate. You know, they felt they were in bad shape. Here was a national company closing down in a downtrodden area. So they felt they were not in good shape, as they weren't. By closing the plant, they had another 2-3 years to go. So we made a settlement of about $80,000 not to arbitrate, not to contest the contract. Okay, but these contracts still have teeth, and in many cases, if we're soliciting a competitor's account, as we do every day, the first thing we ask, have you got a contract? Every customer says, no, they don't. Well, they don't remember, they don't know, and so forth. So we tell them, contact your supplier and ask them to see a copy of the contract. As our customers call us, and they want to see copies of our contract. You know, it's a game that's played. Anyway, all right.
Okay. Well, that you know, you told us a bit about the way the contracts operate, and I take it that during your tenure here, and especially in the early years, you negotiated a number of these contracts.
Well, at least advised. If I didn't negotiate them, I talked with the salesman, and we, you know, we met, like any contract negotiation, you you know, you give and you get and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's not what's written on the paper. It's what's crossed out and added. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get a cup of coffee, if you'll excuse me.
Again.
Okay, go ahead.
Just to clarify for anyone who listens to or reads your oral history, would you explain the difference between the components of your company, that is, a plant, a distribution center, and a route, just so we have a clearer picture of sort of the actual business components of General Linen?
The industry, I don't know if I can make a blanket statement like this, but really doesn't manufacture anything. We are buyers of goods. I took you back in the there. You saw the bales of goods there? Okay. That's goods that we supply to the customer.
Linens, tablecloths.
Linens, napkins. We have about, we must have about 30 different items that we rent. Okay. And a plant is where the goods is cleaned. It comes in soil, the customer uses it, we pick it up with our route trucks, in some cases, well, now we're working 7 days a week. It's unbelievable. We need an eighth day I was thinking, if my father looks down and sees what we're doing, he says, are you crazy or something? How come you're working so long and hard and so forth? Well, that's another story. But we process the goods. The soil comes in every night. Each route has a customer list, and each customer has a specified assigned day or days. In some cases, we're delivering once a month, especially the mat business, which is relatively new. But in some cases, we're delivering 2 and 3 times a day. The casinos were there all the time. Just unbelievable, the volume of linen. That account runs about $25,000 a week in linen. Never happened before, okay? It never happened to us before, or probably in Detroit. Now, there were large accounts in the industrial field, in the manufacturing, General Motors, Ford, where they were supplying work clothes like this shirt, the one I'm wearing now. So that there have been large accounts in the industry, but generally, probably our average account runs we've got 1,700 stops at General Linen right now, and we're just exceeding or reaching $200,000 a week in revenue. So if you divide that, it'll give you your average account, right? And not many like the casino. All right,
the casinos, I want to come back to, because I know that's changed the nature of your business over the last few years. But if I understand this correctly, you've got your plant, and that's cleaning, so it's laundering. Then you have a distribution center, because you have 1,700 routes, and all the drivers...
1,700 customers.
Customers.
1,700 routes.
Yeah, 1,700 routes would be a nightmare. So you have 1,700 customers.
I'd like that kind of nightmare at this moment, but okay.
But then the distribution centers are simply to get the clean linen to a place where the route drivers can pull in, load up, and then your route drivers are...
bring the soil back there.
Right.
We have one branch right now in Toledo. We operated a plant there at one time, but we had a lot of trouble with help and whatnot, so we turned it into a branch from a plant. And we have a guy who works 5-6 days a week, delivers the clean loads every day to the three routes that we have coming working out of the Toledo branch. And at one time, going back to Varsity, when we decided to close down that plant, Varsity became a branch. And we don't use the name Varsity anymore. We lost so much of that business. At one time, we owned the Ann Arbor market. We don't anymore. We're just another company there.
As long as you're speaking, your thoughts just now brought up another question I had, and that is the inroads of national companies into your business. You had mentioned this earlier. I assume you're talking about businesses like Syntax.
Syntax,
rather.
I really hate them. They are bad people anyway, but that's...
Yeah, could you tell us a bit about that situation when they started coming in and how it's affected?
They came in during the strike. They started...
In the 1970 strike.
That's right. There were two strikes. One was the linen strike, which lasted 26 weeks, 28 weeks, whatever it was. And after that, this was Isaac Litwack's final shot. So he wanted to recoup his position by striking the industrial people, which he'd... When our contract was settled, he started in on the industrial laundries, and they had a 26-week strike, okay? But as a result of that strike, our contracts have gotten continuously better, that we can live with it. The national companies previously avoided Detroit like the plague because of this Teamster contract, okay? And so, you know, it's good news, bad news situation. Cintas started in Detroit during the industrial strike. It's like shooting fish in a barrel, okay? You know, here's a plant guy and his employees don't have clothes and they have no way they've got the clothes, but they're soiled. What do they do? You know, they got to take them home, and their wives don't want to wash them, and they're greasy and dirty and, all the other stuff. Anyway, they as I say, because of Isaac's contract, he kept out the national companies. And then the companies began going public. Earlier, the companies were national, but were not public companies. Well, with public company, they got financing. So, you know, you're on a stock market, so hey, you issue stock. What the hell? It's paper. Well, what the hell is it? So they had money to come in, and now, especially the industrial market, which again is more profitable, we must have 5, maybe 6 public companies in this market. Okay? And the good news is they pay high prices to buy out the small company. Okay, if you're a small guy. If you want to sell out, okay? And they have been buying up companies over the last, well, since the strike. It started with that.
So the last 35, 40 years.
Yeah, right. And so forth. Okay, is that?
Yeah, and the national companies have the majority of the industrial business, which is
yes.
Uniforms for factories, manufacturing
right.
shop towels.
Right.
Oh, right.
And mats, yeah.
And mats. Oh, that's interesting. The other thing that, going back to the labor, so, I mean, since the 30s, General Lenin has worked with the labor movement, and it's laundry workers, which were and merged with Teamsters.
Two different. They were the laundry workers were a separate union, a very weak union until recently. They were, again, the unions are merging just like the companies are different. The heirs of the Jewish garment workers
Unite Here
started coming in. You know, and they're bankers. You know, that's not the old time labor unions. They really insurance and anyway, but they are aggressive, and well, politically too. You see this in a political scene.
So they've that's the union you deal with
now.
Now
yeah.
is
they
Unite
were the
Here.
Heir of the laundry workers union, which we had, and. We have pretty good relations. Well, you know, once in a while, an annoying thing comes up. I guess they got to do their business and so forth. For example, we have an employee who has asthma. So, you know, the union has got behind this guy to bug us to put in ventilating systems, which we don't need, and we're not going to cure his asthma, and he really doesn't belong in this kind of environment for his asthma. You know, we're sympathetic to him, but you know, we're not going to spend a couple million dollars to air condition a laundry. It's not in the cards. It's just not economic and so forth. Well, the union is bothering us, so we got to call in experts to check the environment and so forth. So far, we're clean as a whistle, which I want to be. Okay, it's not that I don't want to be, but I certainly don't want to make an investment in filters and all kinds of fancy gadgets they have. Our profit margins don't warrant it.
Yeah. Now, have you had contracts with the Teamsters as well, or you were speaking about the Teamsters dealing with other laundries? Have you had to deal with outside of what you've described already, you don't deal directly with the Teamsters?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What happened as the small companies sold out and went out of business, the union also went out of business. They lost so many members that they merged with the bread union here. So now we're dealing with a bread union that really don't understand our business It's a different psychology and so forth, but we get along with them. Well, we're satisfied. We don't. One of our competitors a couple years ago, and he's now on the rocks, belonged to a group which over the years we belonged to various groups. They called them, what the hell do they call these groups? They would meet periodically with a so-called expert in the field, and they'd meet every 3 months and they'd exchange ideas on, you know, improvements they've made, and we learned a lot, and of course we taught a lot of things that we developed. How did I get on that?
Okay, well, we were speaking, I was trying to get an idea of what unions you've dealt with and deal with.
Well, we actually, we have two unions, the main unions, the Teamsters with our Rotman contract, and you mentioned the name
Unite Here.
Unite Here with our plant people. And the plant people's union has become more militant since it's been taken over by the New York union people and so forth. But it's still, you know, it's still low wage contracts. We're above minimum wage, of course, but not much, and so forth.
About one of the things that has changed the economic environment in Detroit, in metropolitan Detroit, is the advent of casinos over the last 10 to 15 years. It's a tremendous...
Six years. Yeah.
Okay, planning. It has changed tremendously the nature of Detroit. I mean, the planning that had went on for years and years and where to place them, and now it's, multi-million dollar businesses, or they are multi-million dollar businesses. So could you tell us how the casinos has changed your business and your life here?
We're going to go to lunch with my general manager. He is the casino guy. He spent this last year, maybe 6-7 months, every day trying to help the casino organize and decide on what kind of textiles to do. So he really knows it. He was in it, still is in it. And we altered our way we do business.
In what way?
We work Saturdays, we work Sundays, and particularly since they opened the hotels. Now, there's another business that's not only industrial, not linen, but laundry. Until about 4 years ago, 5 years, no, it's more than that, maybe 6 years ago, we only handled our own goods, stuff that we rented, that we owned and we rented. We bought a very expensive machine about 6 or 7 years ago, which gave us a capacity. When we go to the plant, you'll see it, and you know it's amazing what this thing can do. So at that point, we decided to go into the laundry business, and we took on the Marriott Hotel's laundry work. That's a different animal. You know, although you're doing the same process, we control, when it's our goods, we control the inventory. And when it's laundry, they want the goods back before they give it to you. Okay? And so it we had to adjust. I mean, that's something you should really discuss with Terry Nix, okay, a 25-year employee. A jewel of a guy. I mean, really.
Yeah. But what if I understand it correctly, with a hotel, you never know how much laundry they're going to give you on any given day because it depends on their capacity.
Exactly.
or their who's in residence.
Right.
Right. But what about, I mean, just in a basic economic level, how much did this increase your business?
Well,
I mean, ballpark.
Yeah, well,
I'm not asking
example,
for your corporate figures.
Well, all right. If I knew, I might give them to you. I don't know. the Marriott account in laundry runs us about, let's see if I not really know the number, $2,000, $3,000 a week. Okay. And it varies. It's not. Our linen business is stable. Okay, if we have a restaurant and, you know, they're using, they'll serve so many meals, or a caterer, he knows, you know, right to the penny how much labor, how much food he needs, and because of the order, the size of the party, and so forth. In the laundry business, they don't know. They have reservations, and sometimes they're fulfilled, sometimes they're not. So we try to get their booking information ahead of time, so we're somewhat prepared to handle it. But we have all kinds of crises. Terry can tell you. Mm-hmm. This guy works 7 days, 24 hours, and mm-hmm. We have a hotline where a customer is in emergency, who to call. We pride ourselves on service. Nobody in this market gives as good a service. And we've got a devoted staff that carries this out. Okay, without them, we wouldn't be in this position. But it enables us to have an inside track on various. We have a number of national chains that we're serving. Panera, you know
Panera
the name?
Bread.
Panera Bread. Do you know the, come on, what's Whole Foods?
Whole Foods
the markets. Okay. There's got to be a lot more. I can't think of them mm-hmm. right now. Well, that's Terry. He mm-hmm. knows all this stuff. Anyway.
But the casino business, it's safe to say, had a large impact on your business.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had to hire 10 more people in the plant. So, I think, I don't think, maybe we hired an extra routeman. And Terry and his district manager is there daily. They know more about what's going on in the casino than the casino does. This is a giant of an organization. And then people are shipped in from Las Vegas and, you know, that creates more difficulties.
How have you found the experience of working with the casinos?
How?
Yeah, easy, hard?
Well, our relationship, as they say, jump. Our answer is how high. Okay, that explains the relationship. We do what they want and need, mm-hmm. and on time. And that's our whole mantra, is serving their needs, okay? And it's not what we want, it's what they want. And they got some special quality demands that we had to make adjustments for, and so forth. I think we have made those.
Mm-hmm.
We signed with them 5-year contracts.
So steady business for quite some time.
Hopefully, yeah.
All right, well, let's step back a bit again, because there's one thing we haven't discussed in detail, and that is the 1970 strike, which was 26, 28 weeks.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could discuss that a bit.
Yeah, that... well, this was, we thought, and it was, Isaac's last contract. So the industry...
As president of the laundry workers.
Right. He